Chapter 18. I watched the water level in the cockpit intently. It was rising so slowly I almost couldn't see it.
Good news, Joe. Skippy's voice broke my reverie.
What's that?
I didn't get my own hopes up.
Major Smythe's team has rescued the three pilots.
Good. Excellent, I said happily. That is good news.
With a glance at my oxygen meter, I pulled myself upright in the pilot seat.
Connect me to Major Smythe.
You plan to order him to pull back and not risk his people because there is no way for you to get out of there?
Yeah, why?
Major Smythe has already given that order. He is advising Lieutenant Colonel Chang right now.
Oh. Smythe is a wise commander.
I explained the facts to him and he made the logical conclusion.
That's good.
Your people on the surface are not happy about this, Joe.
I am less than pleased also, Skippy.
Oh, good point. That was thoughtless of me. Joe, I am terribly sorry about the whole worm thing. If I hadn't recklessly examined that dead AI canister, you wouldn't be in this mess. I keep thinking that maybe if I had my full magical Skippy capabilities, I would have the brain power to see a way to get you out of there. As it is, I am almost burning out my processors attempting—
Genius! I exclaimed.
Then I proved I am no genius by trying to slap my forehead and smacking my gloved hand into the faceplate of my helmet.
Skippy, you are a freaking genius.
Is your oxygen level that low already? You're not making sense, Joe.
Burn. You said burn, Skippy.
Uh-huh. That is a word, Joe. It comes to modern English from multiple sources. For example, Old Norse has the word—
Great, Skippy, you can nerd out about that later, okay? I'm going to be busy.
Doing what, Joe? Increased activity will deplete your oxygen more quickly.
I'm hoping that will not be a problem, Skippy.
I unstrapped from the pilot seat, preparing myself for ducking into the bone-chilling water. Before I could change my mind, I knelt on the floor of the cockpit and began working on fasteners under the pilot seat.
Joe, what in the hell are you doing down there?
Come on. I'm dying of curiosity.
Burning of curiosity, Skippy.
Burning.
We've covered that subject, Joe.
Not completely.
Tell me, I said as my head went under the dark water to see under the bulky chair.
The cockpit seats in a dragon eject out the bottom of the ship, right?
Yeah, so? You learned that the first day of flight training.
Uh-huh. I did. I grunted from the strain of turning a lever to expose a deck plate below the seat.
And that surprised me. Do you know why?
Because the seats in the main cabin do not also eject? Skippy guessed.
No, it surprised me because when I looked at the belly of a dragon, there are no doors for the cockpit seats to drop down through.
Once again, you have lost me, Joe.
There are no doors— Ah, damn it! Bashed my thumb again. It hurts like a son of—
Anyway, there are no doors in the belly of the cockpit. When the ejection mechanism is engaged, what happens?
Joe, I downloaded the flight manual, so if you are attempting to stump me with questions—
No stumping, Skippy. Answer the question.
When either pilot or the automated flight control system activates the—
Skippy mimicked, taking in a sharp breath.
That is brilliant, Joe.
Before the seats are pushed downward, a section of nanocord burns a rectangular hole through the structure beneath each seat.
You plan to extract the nanocord and use it to burn through the cockpit door?
Bingo, Skippy.
Ugh! That is a pretty freaking good monkey-brained idea. If you had that idea before, I wouldn't have had to drain the damn lake, Joe. Your timing sucks.
Speaking of timing, I checked my oxygen supply, then removed the last deck plate to expose the nanocord. It was a thin, silvery tube, about the diameter of a pencil. Fortunately for me, I knew how to disarm it, and it was comprised of multiple sections, each about 6 inches long.
How do I do this?
Oh, sure, now you need my help.
I always need your help, Skippy.
Except with my love life, I added quickly.
Please help me, oh great and wise one.
Okay, I guess I owe you one. Here's what you do. Under Skippy's direction, I extracted all the nanocord I could reach. 1 6-inch section I curled over twice into a circle and set it at the bottom of the cockpit door,
holding it in place with sealant that was intended to close holes in the hull. The sealant was strong and held the nanocord in place. I used more nanocord to make a bigger circle on the door, large enough for me to fit through. Then I strapped myself securely into the co-pilot seat, since I had partly unfastened the pilot seat from the deck. My brilliant plan would have been worthless without Skippy, because I had no way to activate the microscopic machines in the nanocord. Using my Z-phone as a makeshift communications channel, Skippy took control of the nanocord. This is going to be tricky. I've never done this before. No one has ever done this before. It is going to... I'm running low on oxygen, Skippy, so I'd appreciate you moving things along, okay? My point, Joe, is that I am not 1,000% certain the command I transmit will not activate all the nanocord, not just the small circle stuck to the door. Well, that's not good. How can you be 1,000% certain? Truth? The only way to know for sure is to try it. Hold my beer, Joe. Before I could protest, there was a bright circle of light at the bottom of the cockpit door, and fortunately only from that location. The rest of the nanocord in the big circle remained inert. When Skippy activated the nanocord, the tiny machines went to work, turning into a sort of plasma and burning a hole in the cockpit door. The hole it made was only about an inch across, and yes, I did that math in my head all by myself, smartass. A 6-inch length of nanocord doubled over and wrapped in a circle gives a circumference of about 3 inches, so the diameter of the hole is 1 inch, because pi is 3.14. The way I remember it, it is 2 pi r, where r is the radius of the circle. You make a joke of it, like 2 pi r, delicious, but 3 are better. When I told my father the formula for the area of a circle is pi r squared, he told me that school wasn't teaching me nothing useful because everyone knows pi's around. Cornbread are square. Anyway, that's how I remember what little math I have retained in my head. When the nanocord made a 1-inch hole in the door, high-pressure water came in like a jet, and the cockpit was instantly filled with blinding mist. What air remained was squeezed into a small volume at the ceiling of the cockpit and heated up rapidly as it was compressed. One amazing property of water is that it can't be compressed much, so it stayed icy cold. My helmet got warm, and the rest of me was getting cold fast. Most of my flight suit went rigid to protect me from being crushed, a feature flight suits normally use during ejections. Most of the time, flight suits were trying to keep pressure in, not out. Despite the best effort of my suit, my ears ached from the pressure change, and I leaned my head back and yawned to relieve the pressure on my ears. It worked only part way. When Skippy talked to me, his voice sounded muffled. "Pressure in the cockpit is equalized, Joe. Are you ready?" At least I thought that is what he said. All I really understood was ready, so I guessed the rest. "I'm ready," I shouted. And even my own voice was muffled, like when you have a bad cold and your head is congested. Skippy said something I couldn't quite hear, followed immediately by a light bright enough for my helmet visor to darken automatically. The rest of the nanocord was burning a big hole in the door. As soon as the light flickered out, I didn't wait for an invitation. I unbuckled the safety straps and floated out of the chair. With the flight suit having gone rigid to protect me from being crushed, it was difficult to move. Only the joint areas had any flexibility. Fortunately, all I needed was my shoulders and elbows to move. I let my legs stretch out behind me. That was not easy, because with the bone-chilling cold, I wanted to curl into a ball. The edges of the big hole in the door were already cool from the mass of freezing water by the time I got there. Maybe the plasma had heated the water slightly, or maybe it was my imagination, or maybe I was warming up from the exertion of moving. Thinking about exertion, I checked the meter on my oxygen supply. It was not good. I needed to be careful about breathing too heavily. It would suck to run out of oxygen and die while I was rising to the surface. Squeezing through the hole in the cockpit door, I swung my head around, sweeping the cabin with my helmet lights. What I saw was a mess. Seats and all kinds of equipment had broken loose and were floating around. Wires and cables snaked through the space, creating a severe hazard for me getting tangled up and trapped again. What was worse was the side door. It was blocked most of the way by a rock and mud. Crap! Digging my way out of that heavy mud would use up too much time and oxygen. "What's the holdup, Joe? You need to get moving, dum-dum." "Side door is blocked by whatever the dragon is wedged up against." "What? You've got to be kidding me. This is total bullshit!"
he roared in frustration. "I agree, Skippy." I forced myself to remain calm. "Think, Joe. Think," I told myself. "And think fast. Oxygen is running critically low." The back ramp? No way. The ramp was almost certain to be jammed, or torn apart. Torn. The hull of the Dragon was twisted and ripped. Was there a hole in the cabin I could squeeze through? There was too much junk floating around blocking my view. I needed to get into the cabin. Randomly moving around in all that tangled debris was not appealing. The last thing I needed was to get snagged and trapped by some stupid cable. I had a knife in my ankle holster. The problem was that knife couldn't slice through tough cables, and my gloves were too rigid for me to grasp anything with confidence. The only good move was for me to be careful and plan my moves 2 steps ahead. Wherever I went, I needed an escape route in case I couldn't find a crack in the hull there. The cabin of the Dragon had too many corners with lockers and protruding equipment where I could become trapped too easily. "Skippy, do not tell Major Smythe I am out of here until I am actually on my way up to the surface."
Okay, Joe.
Major Smythe has been rather busy. At the moment, his team has pulled back to the LZ and have set up a defensive perimeter.
Perimeter? What the hell is going on up there?
The Theranin attacked with combots.
How about you concentrate on something you can handle and let the professionals on the surface do their jobs?
Crap, I knew Skippy was right about that, and it renewed my determination to escape from the Dragon. Just then, something moving in the darkness caught the corner of my eye. It was a crack in the hull, a big one. The skin of the hull was shredded and peeled away between 2 structural frames. There were flaps of hull material flapping around in the current, some with jagged edges that might cut my flight suit. A flight suit is not a real spacesuit, and it is not armored. It is for temporary survival, and it can be damaged.
I think I found a way out, Skippy.
That's about freaking time, Joe. You're giving me a heart attack up here.
Move faster!
Moving fast is a bad idea right now, Skippy, I replied as I pulled aside flaps of the outer hull. The material was stiff, and it took a lot of effort for me to bend it aside. Once it was bent, it stayed there. It took me almost 5 precious minutes to move aside enough outer hull to make a hole I could squeeze through without snagging or tearing my suit. Oddly, as I concentrated on carefully making the hole larger, I kept imagining movement at the corner of my eyes, but when I looked, nothing was out there. And then something was. Holy shit! I forgot all about moving slowly and carefully and jerked myself backwards deeper into the Dragon's cabin. A loose cable nearly wrapped itself around my neck before I pulled it away from me.
Hey, Skippy, are there any dangerous animals in this lake?
What I had seen had a lot of shiny teeth, and based on the head, it was at least as big as me.
Like I would know, Joe, Skippy replied in his most sarcastic tone. Let me consult Wikipedia to learn about the native life in that lake.
No, darn it, no wiki entry yet. Come on, Joe. How the hell would I know about some stupid fish in that lake?
Why does it matter? Pop smoke and get out of there. Stop fooling around.
There is something down here with big freaking teeth, Skippy.
Oh, you are afraid of a fish, Joe? He laughed.
Oh, save me from the big bad fishy. I am so scared.
A big fish with big teeth, I insisted.
Fine, he huffed disgustedly.
Pull a couple flares out of a locker and use those to scare the nasty fishies away.
Oh. I was ashamed not to have thought of that. There was a locker right behind me. Moving carefully, I opened the locker. The door was warped, so I had to force it. I reached in and pulled out 2 packs of 4 flares each. Then I went back to the opening I had made in the hull, ignited a flare, and tossed it through. All I saw was a glint of something moving fast. Maybe it was the flick of a tail. All I cared about was that it was moving away from me. And then, after a heart-stopping moment when my right boot caught on a jagged piece of hull, I was out.
I'm out, Skippy.
Reaching for the right side of my flight suit's waistband, I pulled the little orange tab we called the carrot because of the color. It inflated the life vest that wrapped around my shoulders. Pulling the carrot out only 1 notch limited the inflation, as I didn't want to fully inflate it and rock it to the surface.
And now I'm going up. Wish me luck.
As I rose in the darkness, seeing glints of light at the limit of my vision that became more frequent. Whatever it was, There was more than one of them, and they were encircling me, and getting closer.
Major Smythe, Chang called. Colonel Bishop has freed himself from the dragon and is rising toward the surface. His oxygen supply is in question, and there may be a problem with some type of large fish. Skippy was not clear on the risk there. We may need air assets to retrieve Bishop once he is on the surface. Dust off and orbit to the north. Wait for further instructions.
Acknowledged, Smythe replied. Then to himself he breathed, Oh, thank God.
Major? Captain Chandra asked with concern.
Bishop is on the move, toward the surface. We're dusting off to assist retrieval.
That is good news, Chandra clapped his hands. Is there anything we can do right now?
Smythe made a twirling gesture with an index finger for his team to leave their defensive positions and board the dropships.
Right now, I think all we can do is pray.
Following Skippy's instructions meant I was not rising through the black water as quickly as I liked. Once I got out of the sunken dragon, I wanted to zoom to the surface as fast as possible, especially after I saw vague glimpses of large fish near me. Twice, something shiny with big teeth had decided to stop circling me and race in to bite, or at least investigate. The first one I saw only out of the corner of one eye, and I barely had enough time to ignite a flare and wave it frantically at the large predator before it veered away. That time I got a good look at it. The best Earth equivalent was a tuna, because it was skinny side to side instead of being kind of flat on the bottom like a shark. In case you think I am a coward for being afraid of tuna, you weren't in the water with me. This freshwater gingerbread tuna shark had big, shiny, sharp teeth that any shark on Earth would find scary, and the tuna was at least 5 or 6 meters long. The damn thing clearly intended to bite a chunk out of me until the flare blinded it or scared it away. Those flares were intensely bright. They were designed to be used as emergency signals in space and had to be visible from thousands of kilometers away. The visor of my flight suit automatically darkened to protect my eyes, but the tuna had no such advantage, and I hoped the light had it swimming around blindly crashing into things. Things that were not me. Assuming the tuna lived deep in the lake, their eyes were not used to bright light, so they might take a while to recover their vision. Either that first tuna shark's eyes adjusted quickly, or they used senses like smell to locate their prey, or another tuna decided to try its luck, because the flare had just sputtered out when my visor's enhanced vision warned me about another threat approaching. That time I had a second flare ready and I popped the cap to ignite it. Through my automatically darkened visor, I saw the tuna veer off when it was maybe 12 or 10 meters away, uncomfortably close. As it spun around, it flicked its powerful tail and the rush of water slammed into me, flinging my arms and legs around and making me drop the flare. The bright flare fell away from me, spinning as it descended into the depths. That was the last of the first pack of 4 flares. While I was still tumbling through the water, I used both hands to dig the second pack of 4 flares out of a thigh pocket, gripping the pack like my life depended on it, because it did. Apparently, an active flare was adequate protection against tuna sharks, even though it was dropping away below me. There was not another fish rushing at me until the sinking flare was far enough beneath me to dim more than halfway. By that time, I had another flare firmly gripped in both hands, with the remaining 3 tucked securely away in a breast pocket for quick access. With only 4 flares left, and the hazy light of the surface still too far away, I didn't ignite a flare when the tuna shark appeared at the edge of my vision. This predator fish wasn't swimming at me yet, it was circling me slowly. Only when it twisted its body to rocket toward me did I ignite the flare. My activating the flare was rewarded by the tuna turning abruptly away and disappearing into the underwater gloom. Visibility in the lake sucked. Draining away a good portion of the water had stirred up silt and air bubbles so that without the enhancements of my helmet's visor, I might not have seen a tuna shark until its powerful jaws crunched me to bits.
Skippy, why are these fish so eager to attack me?
It is possible they are attracted to the electromagnetic field your flight suit generates.
Oh, that is just freaking great. The flight suit kept me breathing and from being crushed by water pressure, but now I'm going to be eaten by a goddamn fish?
That is a danger, but your oxygen supply may be more a hazard to you. Joe, you are breathing too rapidly. You must calm down or you will run out of oxygen before you reach the surface.
Calm down.
As I said that, I barely saw the silver-gray shape of a tuna shark swimming through the gloom left to right in front of me.
You try it first. Come down here and see how calm you are when giant fish are trying to make you their dinner.
Joe, while I appreciate your dilemma, your emotional response does not alter the facts. Your oxygen supply is almost depleted. Shouting at me is only making the situation worse.
Crap. He was right and I knew it.
Against every animal instinct, I forced myself to calm down, going almost limp, except for the two hands gripping the burning flare. The red light flashing in the upper left corner of my visor was alerting me to the dire state of my oxygen supply. I didn't need a status indicator. I could feel the air supply growing thin as the mask's tube drew the last dregs of pressurized oxygen from the tiny emergency bottle.
That is good, Joe. Do not reply. You need to save your breath. Literally.
That was funny. I have adjusted your suit's heating controls to send pulses through the heating elements. Those pulses are acting to cancel the suit's natural magnetic field. Not cancel it completely, but my hope is the altered magnetic signature will deter predators, or at least make you less tasty to the fish. There is another piece of good news. I have analyzed images of these tuna sharks from your visor. In my opinion, these are deep water predators and will stop their pursuit of you as you near the surface. While that is a guess, it is a skippy guess, so you can be very confident in my analysis. If you do get eaten by a tuna shark at the surface, you can take comfort that I will be horribly embarrassed. My forced relaxation slipped a bit as my jaw clenched, but I did not reply. By that time, in addition to Skippy's voice in my ears, I was listening to increasingly strident warnings from the flight suit's alarm, notifying me that there was less than 10 seconds of oxygen remaining. I tilted my head back to judge how close I was to the surface. The water above me was still depressingly dark.
Must ascend faster. Oxygen gone.
Huh? Oh, it is. Ah, what the hell, you're close enough anyway. Without me doing anything, the torso of the flight suit expanded, and I felt the life vest around my shoulders inflate. Unfortunately for me, the inflation gas was helium rather than oxygen, but I felt myself being jerked upward as I gasped to suck in the last molecules of O2 from the bottle. And then, as my eyes were bulging and blood roared in my ears, I popped to the surface. It was a chaotic hell. Waves slammed me around, tossing me head over heels. Just as I managed to get my head above the water and reached up with one arm to pop the seal on my helmet faceplate, a wave broke right on top of me, pounding me under the surface and flinging my legs up in the air. Knowing opportunities to breathe would be fleeting, I got the faceplate unlatched with one hand and almost swallowed a mouthful of water. The churning waves dropped me into a trough, and I sucked in as much air as I could before a wave smacked me in the face. For a time I couldn't track. I did nothing but focus on floating and breathing when I could. While my head was underwater, I blew out, and quickly inhaled when the capricious waves tossed me briefly upward. Skippy's drain in the lake had caused violent waves that had no pattern. They weren't like the ocean where waves could be tremendously powerful, but at least all went in the same direction. The part of the lake I was in had waves coming from all directions, crashing into each other, building on one another, and then dropping the bottom out from under me. There was so much water spray in the air I choked every time I breathed in. I had heard of water spray saturating the air, creating problems for Coast Guard rescue swimmers who had to breathe under the furious downdraft of a helicopter. There was no helicopter or dropship above me. My problem was caused only by the top layer of lake water violently sloshing back and forth. Skippy was shouting something in my ear. I couldn't understand him with my helmet part filled with water, and I didn't have the time or strength to reply. I did notice my life vest had fully deployed without me doing anything, and that did help keep my head above the water.
Joe! An ear-bursting sound blasted around my helmet. Close faceplate!
That I understood. With my emergency oxygen bottle depleted, closing the faceplate would cut off my air supply, but I didn't argue. During a moment between waves battering my face, I slapped the faceplate closed.
Got it, I whispered weakly.
Pumping water, Skippy answered tersely. There was a high-pitched whirring noise, and the water level inside the helmet began draining away, making a slurping suction sound. And then I was able to breathe, even when my head was under the water.
Thanks, was all I could say. Joe, if you are going to fly, you need more regular stick time. You completely forget emergency procedures. He was right. I'd completely forgotten about the air-purifying feature of the Krestang helmets. The helmets we used with our Krestang flight suits were basically the same as the helmets of powered armor spacesuits, except the helmets for pilots had less armor protection and didn't include targeting sensors for personal weapons. Both types of helmets were capable of filtering and concentrating oxygen from contaminated atmospheres to reduce the need for a person to rely on internal stores of oxygen. That feature couldn't act like gills and extract oxygen from water, so it wouldn't have helped me until I got to the surface. But now that I was no longer under deep water, the helmet could pull oxygen from the water-saturated air. Even while I was still being bounced around by waves and the helmet's intakes could only get intermittent access to air, I was able to breathe a steady supply. Getting all the oxygen I needed made a huge difference. I was able to think and plan ahead. The wave action had no pattern to it, so I could use it to determine which way was the closest shore. Skippy, can you point me toward land? The closest land to you is the eastern shore of the lake. You do not want to swim in that direction. Here, a yellow arrow popped up inside my faceplate, is the direction you should swim. Great. Thanks. That arrow bounced around a lot as I clumsily struggled through the water. I was only able to make slow progress in the correct direction. It seemed like an endless time, but probably only 10 or 15 minutes, that I splashed my way through the water. At the foaming crest of a wave, I caught a glimpse of the new shore of the lake, which had been deep underwater until Skippy's Roto-Rooter service arrived to unclog the drain. What I saw was not encouraging. It was a whole lot of mud and something like dark green kelp dotted with rocks here and there. There was a cliff looming over me, so I swam away from that. The waves were crashing there and would have crushed me against the face of the cliff. The relatively flat area I aimed for was almost as bad for me. I tried to time when I reached the new beach, but the waves had a different agenda. One wave picked me up and broke as I tried frantically to swim back away from the beach. I got slammed down into mud. Then the wave was retreating and dragging me back out into the lake with it. 3 times I attempted to get out of the water, and my final success was due to luck rather than skill or athletic ability. When I found myself face down in a mudflat, I crawled on my belly to get away from the wave that was tugging my legs backwards. Being out of the water was almost worse than being in the water. No, it was absolutely worse. What used to be the bottom of the lake was now clinging, sticky, slippery mud like quicksand. As soon as I got away from the last wave, I wanted to turn around and get back in the water. By the time my slow brain made that decision, it was too late. I was sinking fast into the mud. An attempt to crawl on hands and knees only made me flip over and sink halfway into the mud. I nearly drowned in mud. Getting back on my belly helped a bit, and I swam awkwardly on my belly to a flattened bed of a sort of kelp that had been growing on the lake bottom. There were eel-like things either dead or flopping around on and under the kelp. Clawing at the kelp, I was able to pull myself on top of it for a momentary respite. No sooner had I stopped for a breather when 3 things happened. The already rotting kelp began pulling apart under my weight. I realized the air inside the helmet was getting stale, and 2 rifle rounds splattered the mud to my left.
Joe, the Theranin are shooting at you.
What do you think? Standard infantry carbines only now. They do not appear to have another sniper rifle. Yet. Also, the air intake on the back of your helmet is completely clogged with mud, and I can't fix it. You need to open your faceplate. I followed instructions without comment, swinging the faceplate fully open. Ugh, the smell of rotting kelp, fish, and eels was awful. Another rifle sound sent up a fountain of mud to my right, farther away. The Theranin were either at the maximum effective range of their carbines or they were very out of practice with marksmanship. To my right was a wave-formed ridge of mud about 2 meters high. I pulled myself over the kelp, sinking into it, until I was to the west of the mud ridge. From there, I dared not move any farther, fearing the soft strands of kelp beneath me would give way and trap me in the mud below.
Skippy, I can't move. Well, I can move, but I'm not walking out here by myself. This mud is too soft and too sticky. If I slip off this bed of kelp, I'll sink in that mud like quicksand.
Oh, crap. All right, fine. Help is on the way. We are sending a Krestang armored suit down to you. I figured you would need the enhanced speed and power of a mech suit if the Theranin was shooting at you. How are you getting a suit down here to me?
We're dropping it from high altitude. There is a dropship safely beyond missile range above you now. I think it's beyond missile range.
You're joking, right? What is your plan? Push an empty armored suit out the back ramp of a Falcon, let it splat down here, and I'm supposed to pick up the pieces?
Of course not, dum-dum, Skippy sounded exasperated. The suit will be attached to a paraglider that will bring it over you, then flare out into a chute to lower it. I'll use the jets in the boots to set it down softly right close to you.
Cool, huh?
Uncool, Skippy. That suit weighs more than I do. You drop one here and it will sink into the mud and be buried.
No, it won't. Well, shit, let me check.
Damn.
Yes, he sighed. The monkey is right about that. Crap!
Forget the mech suit, Skippy. What is your plan B?
The mech suit was my plan B, you idiot. Plan A was for you to walk out of there.
I never thought you would let a squishy little puddle of mud stop you.
It's not a little mud, Skippy. It's a freaking ocean of quicksand.
Yeah, well, I'm still very disappointed in you and your entire species right now, Joe. When your ancestors crawled out of the mud onto land millions of years ago, they were so pleased with themselves. But that decision doesn't look so good now, does it?
I can't argue with that logic, Skippy, but mud has defeated many military campaigns on Earth, no matter what technology the armies had.
You got a plan C in your awesome mind?
Give me a moment to think. Jeez Louise, you are impatient.
Just then, the rotting mat of kelp beneath me gave way a bit, and a thin fountain of watery mud shot up like a jet. I felt my left boot sink into mud. To make the situation even better, a rifle round smacked into the mud puddle to my right, having gone right through the ridge of mud I was hiding behind.
Take all the Skippy time you want, but I need a solution in about 10 seconds of meat sack time.
Fine, he huffed.
Okay, ha! I got it, smartass. Help will be on its way very shortly. I am walking the pilots through the instructions now.
We are not risking a dropship overflying the lake to rescue me, Skippy.
Never fear, Joe. No dropships will be harmed in the production of this truly awesomely cool stunt.
Crap. This is your idea, and even you think it is a stunt. What is this awesomely cool plan?
Well, Joe, you are not going to like this.